Do you have an idea for a podcast, but you don't know where to start? Maybe you're overwhelmed by all the tech or you're convinced nobody will actually listen to you. Well, I'm Shauna Game. After 9.5 years as a professional podcaster, at this show, Everyone's Talking Money, and 25 million downloads later, let me tell you the secret to a profitable podcast. It is building a solid foundation, your podcast roadmap before you launch. That's why I created the Podcaster Class, a fast-paced group cohort podcasting for profit 8-week style MBA program. The Podcaster Class is immersive, comprehensive, and insanely motivational. If you want to create a podcast, DIYing a launch is just not the way to go. In the Podcaster Class, you'll get the tools, tips, and strategies to create a podcast that resonates with listeners and one you can be proud of. Get this, 90% of podcasters never make it to episode 3. That's 2.8 million podcasters who just quit. So to be a top podcaster, you only need to publish 21 episodes, but you got to make them good. So in the Podcaster Class, I'm taking the mystery out of how to create, launch, and profit from your podcast so you can create a top 1% podcast just like this one. The May cohort is now open for enrollment. Classes start May 22nd. There are only 15 spots open. You are going to learn podcasting with me and 14 other amazing people. You can learn all the details at thepodcasterclass.com. Use code podcast when you sign up for $100 off. That's thepodcasterclass.com. You know I'm a big fan of enjoying life while still being smart financially. That's why I love ButcherBox. I can get a variety of high-quality meat, seafood, chicken, and pork at an amazing value, all with exclusive member deals delivered to my door with free shipping always. One thing I just never wanted to cut out of my spending plan is eating good food. And with ButcherBox, I don't have to, and neither do you. Where else can you get free protein for a whole year? Yes, you heard that right. One of my favorite go-to dinners is a salmon bowl. I'm not even a huge salmon lover, but ButcherBox's wild-caught salmon is oh so good. I make a nice little marinade, saute some veggies, cook the salmon, and throw in some Weiss. And it is an amazing dinner. If you want to take less trips to the grocery store and always have prepared meat in the freezer for a lot less money, you need ButcherBox in your life. Sign up at butcherbox.com/ETM and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/ETM. Buying your first house is no joke. From the down payment to the mortgage to finding the right house to the paperwork and more, it can be quite a process. So how do you buy your first house with ease and avoid some rookie, aka costly mistakes? Find out in this episode.
You're listening to Millennial Money with award-winning money expert and serial entrepreneur, Shauna Compton-Game, where we flip the script on the old school approach to everything your parents never taught you about money. Each week, Shauna creates a safe space by talking with special guests from around the world about money wellness, entrepreneurship, traveling like a boss, and what makes millennials tick. Unique stories, trailblazing perspectives, tips, tricks, and everything there is to know about money. Find it all here as you uncover your money story and unlock the life you want to live. Pretty cool, right? Here's Shauna, money expert, Indiana Hoosier, and burger aficionado.
I bought my first house at 24, which I've shared on this show before, and I had no idea what I was doing. Like, literally no idea. I knew that I had a house that I really liked, and somehow there was going to be money exchanged, and I was going to have to pay a mortgage, but everything in the middle was just a complete blur. I sometimes wish I could just go back and feel that free again to make choices without really thinking them through. It all ended up okay, but it was definitely a scary process and a lot of money involved, even more money than I thought at the beginning. But maybe that's the beauty of buying your first house. But I want something different for you. Scott Trench and Mindy Jensen, co-hosts of the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast and authors of the new book, First Time Homebuyer, are our guests on this episode to share how to buy your first home, why your purchase really isn't an investment, the importance of an exit strategy, and why you shouldn't think about buying a house without a reserve fund. So go ahead, press pause on HGTV and tune in for this How to Buy a Home episode. You both wrote this great book, First Time Homebuyer, which of course is like the Bible for first time homebuyers, if you will. And I thought we would just start out at the beginning with kind of a gusto. What are some of the like biggest rookie mistakes that you see first time homebuyers make? Like, what are those things over and over again that just make you cringe?
Yeah, I would start off with at the strategy level, but before you like even talk about buying a place in the wrong spot or with some sort of unchangeable feature like next to the train tracks, and you find out really the first thing I would start with is the strategy and thinking through what am I going to do when I leave this property? Because the average person is staying in a home for about 7 years here in America. And so are you going to, you know, when you buy the home, you know, you're not probably going to live there forever if you're the average person nowadays here in 2021. So I think that the biggest mistake you make is not thinking through exit strategies. And what is an exit strategy? It's what happens long-term for you at the property. And there are three basic exit strategies. One is I live in the property happily ever after for the rest of my life. And a lot of people tend to overweight this one. But it is an important one, and you need to be happy with your home in order to make this a sound investment and a sound decision for yourself. The second exit strategy would be to move out of the property and keep it, perhaps as a rental, either a short-term rental or a long-term rental. And if you're going to do that, ideally it's good to make money on that and not subsidize somebody else's house lifestyle by losing money every month with that type of, by holding it as a rental. And the third exit option is to sell the property, and ideally you sell it for a gain for more than you purchased it for and recoup your down payment and all those other things after closing costs. And I think that folks just don't take a moment and basically think through what's going to happen downstream. The more you can frame the strategy of your first-time home purchase around maximizing the potential of those three exit options, the better off you're going to be. The better cash flow it produces as a rental, the better you're going to be. The more value you can add, or the more that the market appreciates around you, the better off you're going to be. And the happier you are in the property, the better off you're going to be.
And tagging off of that, one of the things that prevents people from thinking about these three scenarios is falling in love with the property. They walk in and it's gorgeous. I have to have this house. I can promise you, as a real estate agent, a real estate investor of more than 20 years, there's another house that's even better. So don't fall in love with the property so much so that you make emotional decisions rather than rational or even mathematically intelligent decisions.
Yeah, and that's so hard to do. I'm thinking back to when I bought my first house, and you really have to, before you walk in the doors, keep reminding yourself, don't get emotionally attached. There are things you can change in the property, things you can't change in the property. And thankfully, when I bought my first house, HGTV wasn't a thing yet. So I would imagine that it's a little bit more difficult after all these house shows that you get a little boggled up in your thinking. But Mindy, I'm curious for you, is buying a house right for everyone? Like, how do you begin to evaluate that?
One of the first things you need to do is look at the market that you find yourself in and look at your intentions that you have. I know people who say, I'm only going to live here for 2 years. If that's the case, maybe buying a house isn't the best choice. Certainly not a perfect house, unless you can run the numbers and the rent makes sense. But if you're going to be there for 2 years, you're going to pay closing costs when you purchase the home, which is roughly, but not, I mean, don't hold me to this, but it's roughly 2-4% when you're going into the house. When you sell it, it's a lot more like 7-9%. Wow. So that's a huge amount of money that I think people don't even start to think about before they jump into the home purchase. Again, oh, it's time for me to buy a house because I just paid off my credit card, or I finally paid off my student loans, or it's never a good time to buy a house just because you paid off another debt. It's a good time to buy a house when you are financially secure. You have plans to be there for a long time. and you are comfortable with your decision and your space in life, you know, you've got a good job. We can go on and on about that. But to make a financial decision like this should be approached in a rather, I don't want to say slow manner, because you don't want to act quickly right when you find something, but in an intelligent manner. Don't be so desperate to buy a house that you decide today I'm going to buy one, tomorrow I put an offer on a house, unless you've done your research. Scott has quite the suggestion for finding a house, and it doesn't really have much to do with what's on the market now.
All right, Scott, so you got to tell us.
So I think it's a deliberate process to buy the house, right? And so you say, okay, great. I've decided on my exit strategies, and I've decided, for example, I want a place that would break even as a rental so that I have the option to leave the place within a year or two, with a unfinished basement or some other type of thing I can add value on, whatever, right? Like something that, but in this neighborhood where I'm going to be happy, something that gives me the best blend of those three exit options from a strategic sense. Next step is to write down exactly what I want. So there's five steps in this process. First is figure out what you want. And this is not like an intensive process. Just put like two paragraphs down on paper and say, like, I want a 3-bed, 2-bath. The second bathroom is very important, or at least the second half bath is very important, I think, for a lot of folks. I want 2 3-beds, 2-baths, a couple thousand, you know, 1,500 square feet, 2,000 square feet. I want whatever it is, right? And a 2-car garage, yard, this area of town. Just put it down on paper. And then you sit back and you say, am I living in fantasy land or reality? And the way you test that is you go talk to an agent and you ask them to send you all, or you go on Zillow or Redfin or whatever, and you look at the sold properties in the last 180 days. And you say, great, has anything that meets my description in my price range actually sold in my market in the last 180 days? And this is really important, because what most people do is they look at the active listings, and what is for sale now might be the bad properties. It might be a property that's overpriced or has something horribly wrong with it. And so you get scared off by what's the market, but it may be that properties are coming on the market and going off the market in 2 days that meet your criteria all the time. So let's say that you do this exercise. And you see, you know, so you know, step one is determine what you want. Step two is look at the sold listings. Step three would be to calmly prepare to act aggressively, right? And so what that means is, great, there are 10 properties that have met my criteria in the last 180 days. That means that one property is coming in the market every 18 days, every 2.5 weeks. And I know that's a good deal for me, because I've determined that there's only 10 properties. Those 10 are the good deals out of the thousands that have sold in my area, or hundreds. Great, that's a good deal. And so what happens then is I need to be ready to offer on that property at the price point I've predetermined that's fair based on what other things have sold on the moment it comes in the market. So if that property comes in the market at 2:30 in the afternoon, maybe I'm not like quitting work early, but I'm canceling my evening plans and I'm going to call my agent and call my lender, make sure I got a pre-approval, and I'm writing an offer that night or the next day to make sure I've got a chance at winning the bid. And I might lose 2 or 3, but I know that there will probably be 5 to 10 in the next 6 months that allow me to win there. So I skipped a step here. But a part of this is don't allow an artificial constraint to dictate your timeline. What's an example of this? I'm moving to a new city, and therefore I need to buy a house coinciding with my move. Or my lease expires on June 30th, therefore I need to buy my property before June 30th and move in. Right? Those are artificial constraints. Talk to your landlord. Move into a short term. Do something that allows you to make a cool, calm, and collected decision so you're not rushing a $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 purchase, probably the biggest purchase of your life, and potentially costing yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars from a strategic sense, or tens of thousands of dollars by overbuying or paying for something at the last minute to coincide with your timeline. You know, paying $200 a month extra to go month to month with your landlord might cost you $800 and you'll feel it, but it might give you $10,000 better outcome over the end of it. So anyways, those are some of the, that would be a framework to think about, some version of that in buying your home to make sure you can get a good deal.
That's a great framework. I love that because it's a really systematic way to think about things. And I'm thinking, I've been asked this by my friends, particularly over the last year, because even though we've been in COVID and various versions of that around the United States, there's been a lot of really hot property markets. I live in Los Angeles and I have a lot of friends that are trying to buy a house because they don't want to live in their one bedroom condo anymore. And the market is just absolutely crazy. So I know that's not everywhere around the United States. It's not happening everywhere, but how do you factor these crazy markets that are happening now and know whether that makes sense? I know a lot of the framework that you've talked about, but how do you maybe logically think through some of that?
Well, first start with the market, right? And so is the market overpriced right now? Well, there's a lot of mixed opinions on that. And I don't think anyone can accurately predict it. There's good, you know, hey, yeah, interest rates just fell. So if they go back up, you know, when interest rates fall, you can afford more property because you can afford the same payment buys more property because it's a lower interest rate, right? So interest rates and housing prices are tightly linked. So you might be sitting there thinking, like, oh, interest rates can't go any lower. They might go up, in which case the market's going to fall. But other people are saying, hey, interest rates are likely to stay low for several years now. And we just printed all this money with stimulus packages and those types of things. So maybe inflation is coming around and maybe there's a big boom happening in 2021. So the answer is no one can really know if now is a good time or not in the market. And so that's why I think you should focus on the things that you can control. And those things are, what are my exit strategies? Am I in a strong financial position from which to buy property right now? You know, and going back to those exit strategies, you know, am I going to be happy with my purchase for a long period of time? The longer my time horizon that I'm willing to live there, the more likely it is to be that buying a home is going to be a better alternative to renting. I think that break-even point is somewhere between 5 and 7 years for those things. Am I willing to buy a place and change my criteria such that I'll live in a place that would make sense as a rental, or long-term or short-term? Am I willing to move into a place that I'm willing to, you know, live in and flip and do a lot of rehab work to add value to the property, which lowers my risk? So the stronger a position you can put yourself in, the better, regardless of market conditions. And I think depending on who you ask, there's a good case to be made that now is a terrible time to buy real estate and that now is a great time to buy real estate.
Ah, yes, the dilemma. I love that because there never is the quote unquote perfect time, unless of course somebody's giving you a house for free, then of course you're going to take that offer. But you both talked about some money moves that you should think about making before you think about buying a house. What are some of those smart money steps that you think everybody needs to think about or have in place before they even begin this process?
Something's going to break when you buy that house. I've bought and sold more houses than a lot of people that I know. And it's something always breaks. And I'm buying dumpy houses, but I've bought nice houses too. And there's always something that breaks. If you go into the property knowing that it needs a new roof, you need to have that money set aside for the new roof. If you're going into a property and you don't know that it needs a new roof, or you should start saving up for that roof. If you don't have any money, there are some loan programs. I don't know that there's many 0% down loan programs. There's the VA program and the USDA program. And both of those are special circumstance programs. But the FHA loan will allow you to get into a property at 3.5%. Conventional, I think, goes down to 3% or 5%. That's not very much money in the context of how much the house is costing. You should have extra money in an emergency fund for when the something breaks so that you can easily repair it instead of frantically repair it. Easily repair it means you can call several service providers, get quotes, and choose the one that you are most comfortable with. Frantically repairing it means you have to find the cheapest guy. And I can tell you from personal experience, the cheapest guy almost never is the best guy.
Yeah, there's a saying on Bigger Pockets that, you know, if you think the $100 an hour electrician is expensive, try hiring the $10 an hour electrician and you'll find out what expensive is.
I think that needs to be on a bumper sticker, Mindy, or a t-shirt or something.
A t-shirt. Yes, I'll give it to all my electrician friends. And you need to have the money for not only your down payment, but your closing costs. Like I said earlier, it's going to cost you 2 to 4% of the purchase price of the home in closing costs. You have all sorts of inspections that you should be doing. You have, even if your contract isn't contingent upon those inspections, which I think it should be, you should still be doing those inspections so you know what you're getting into when you purchase the house. There's title insurance and attorney fees in some states. There's like a whole host of these little nitpicky charges that, you know, when you're putting 3.5% down on a $100,000 house, you're like, okay, $3,500, I've got that. No, you need more like $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to cover all these things on top of your emergency fund. Have a steady job, have a stable source of income because your mortgage payment is due every single month and you're not going to get that mortgage if your income is all wompy and iffy.
In those moments when money is just not moving as fast as your dreams, Earnin provides the financial momentum you need to keep moving forward. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you access up to $100 a day as you work, and you can leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. I honestly would use Earnin in lots of different ways, but what's on my mind recently is I need a night out. I need some good tacos to sip on a few virgin margaritas and celebrate you all helping this podcast earn 26 million downloads. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, when I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. Gives me a lot of peace of mind. Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Talkin' Money under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. Talkin' Money under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank & Trust, member FDIC. I'm sorry, but I have the best dog ever. Her name is Winnie Stardust. She is a mini golden mountain doodle full of life, and I would do just about anything to keep her happy, healthy, and safe. Today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Your pet is part of your family, and you want to do the best for them. But vet bills can really add up. We jokingly keep telling Winnie she needs to get a job to pay for her vet bill. That's why you should check out pet insurance. And with ASPCA Pet Health Insurance, you can focus on the care your pet deserves and cover what matters most. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customized accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping to ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you are least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independent American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer, is not engaged in the business of insurance. I'm going to be real with you. Identity theft is on the rise, and you do not want to wake up one morning and discover that your bank account has been emptied, or you're overdue on credit cards you never even applied for. We talk about this often on the podcast, but you don't realize how much of your information is available to scammers on the internet and how susceptible you and your family are to identity theft and fraud. I know, it's scary, but now you can get your data removed with DeleteMe. That's why I personally choose Delete Me. Delete Me is a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process, helps prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I just started using Delete Me, and I got my regular personalized privacy report, and I was shocked what they found and removed. It was pages of information about me that I did not want online. Here's how it works. You sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt to have Delete Me. And you know, it's also a great service for your parents or grandparents to help protect them from identity theft. Delete Me is not just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you do not want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special price for my listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use promo code ETM at checkout. The only way you get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and enter code ETM at checkout. joindeleteme.com/ETM. Go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use code ETM for 20% off. Okay, friend, I want to know, what are your money goals this year? Are you saving to buy a house or maybe a wedding or a dream vacation to somewhere tropical? If that's you, please, please take me with you. Or maybe you want to just grow your emergency fund because, let's be real, life is expensive. I want to make sure you reach your goals, so you need Monarch. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Here's what I love. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard. You can go between light and dark mode. You can create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up all of these automatic rules for your transactions and notifications, and so much more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving their product. Get this. They release updates every 2 weeks, and they even allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. This, my friend, is totally original. Plus, they will never sell your data to third party or show you ads. I think that's really important. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it is the top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this show get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial.
Whatever you're saving up for, a CD from Sandy Spring Bank lets you grow your savings at a guaranteed rate. Right now, earn interest at 4.5% APY on an 8-month CD special or 4.25% APY on a 14-month CD special. Learn more at sandyspringbank.com/cdspecials. Minimum opening deposit to earn the annual percentage yield is $500 for the 8-month CD special and $2,500 for the 14-month CD special. Member FDIC.
Yeah, I want to chime in here and just kind of reinforce something that having a good income, good credit, a cash for the down payment, cash for expected reserves, cash for expected repairs you're going to make right after you buy the property and a reserve. That's important. That can sound like an overwhelming position, but I just want to like reinforce that a low down payment is an option. It's not irresponsible, in my opinion, to buy a property with 3.5% down using a conventional or FHA loan, assuming the PMI. So if you're buying a $400,000 home, 5% would be $20,000. 3.5% would be, something like that.
Close enough.
Yeah. So you're talking about that kind of as the down payment, plus maybe you have $5,000 in repairs, that's $20,000, plus maybe $10,000 or $15,000 in reserve. So the putting down 25% and coming up with those things, you're looking at like $100,000 or $115,000. You don't need that to buy your first house. But you do need a fraction of that, a meaningful fraction of that, that accounts for those reserves, I think, to be responsible. So anyways, I just wanted to chime in with that.
No, I appreciate that, Scott. I think a lot of people hear that the VA loan, the USDA, loan are 0% down. I don't think you should have no money in your bank account before you buy a house.
Yeah, it's probably more responsible to have a solid reserve with a 0% down VA loan than it would be to put down $100,000 and have nothing in your bank account, right? To cover those kinds of expenses.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know there are a million and one calculators online of what you can afford, but is there some sort of simple or maybe not simple mathematical equation where you can at least get a rough estimate of what you could actually afford based off your income, expenses, et cetera?
Yeah, we don't answer that question in the book. And here's why. Because we don't think that's a question you should be asking. The housing is an expense, first and foremost. And the more you buy, the worse off you are, whether that's the more you pay for rent or the bigger and nicer house that you buy, generally speaking, because you can be putting that money somewhere else. So to find out how much you can qualify for, you can just put it into a mortgage calculator. You can just Google that and you'll be able to find out how much you can qualify for from a mortgage perspective. But I think that you have to understand that framework, that housing is an expense and you want to buy the exactly what you need. You want to reduce the scope and your desire, that wish list, to what you need and maximize your exit options and go from there. And ideally, you're buying well within the amount that you can qualify for from a mortgage perspective.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. And it brings up another question. We grow up with this memo, sort of unconscious memo. I think we go to college, we graduate, we get married, we buy a house, we have a kid. There's some sort of a way we're supposed to journey through life. And the buying the house thing has always been talked about, that you buy a house, it's an investment, it's an asset. I'm just curious of you guys' thoughts on this. Is the house in itself an investment? Is that how we should think about it?
No, the house is an expense. You can build equity in it, so it can be cheaper than renting. But let's use that. Remember what Mindy said earlier about closing costs? Let's say I buy a $400,000 home and I pay 3% of that in closing costs up front, $12,000. I put down 10%, $40,000. Okay. So right now my equity in the property, or the amount I'm down, is I've put $40,000 in and I have $28,000 in equity. But I don't really have $28,000 in equity, because remember Mindy said it would cost 7% probably on the low end to sell the property. 7% right. Of $400,000 is, 1% is 4, 4 times 7 is 28. Right. So it's going to cost me $28,000 to sell the property. So if I buy that property, I put down $40,000, I'm out $12,000 in closing costs, I sell it tomorrow for $28,000, that's $40,000. I've lost $40,000 if I buy the property and turn around and sell it tomorrow. So the only way I offset those costs is if I hold the property long enough for appreciation to increase its value by more than that amount, and or I pay down the mortgage slowly, which on average, if you agree with us and assume a 3.5% appreciation rate on average, that's going to be between 5 and 7 years, about whether that's a better decision to buy an equivalent place versus rent. And it's going to depend, and that's a complete generalization, it's going to depend on a whole bunch of things, like what kind of things can you rent, what kind of things can you buy, what's the appreciation rate in your area, all of those dynamics will play in. But in general, and we have a calculator for this that's available as part of the bonus with the book. But in general, it's probably going to be between 5 and 7 years between whether it's going to be better to buy or rent. So if you're going to live in the property for more than 5 to 7 years, buying can be less expensive than renting. But it's not, in neither case are you building wealth. And again, the less you buy, the less you pay in rent, or the less home you purchase, the less you lose over time as a rule.
I want to circle back and answer that question as well, because you're right. You hear this all the time. Your home is an investment. Your home is a really expensive purchase, but a really expensive purchase is not an investment. It is a really expensive purchase. My home is an investment, but my home is really ugly when I buy it. It is the house that I'm sitting in right now was owned by a smoker. He lived here for 40 years. I'm sure you can imagine how wonderful my home smelled when I bought it. During his time here, he did nothing to the home. So I still have the 1979 cabinets and countertops and bathrooms and all the things. And the basement was unfinished. The windows were original. I got it at a significant discount because my home is an investment, but I am forcing the appreciation in this house. Some numbers just to throw at you to hear those. I bought this house for $365,000, and the house around the corner, it's a cookie cutter neighborhood. So the house around the corner, the same house design, sold 3 or 4 months before I bought my house for $598,000. Theirs was a little nicer. So I've got a lot of space between what I bought this for and what this model all fixed up is selling for. So I can go pretty crazy with what I'm going to do on the inside of the house. But because it's my primary residence, I'm living in a construction zone. So there's a lot of trade-offs. I'm willing to live in a construction zone because that's what I pay, $365, and they $600. So that's, I should really do this math before I come on a podcast.
Mindy puts in a ton of work to these properties. She buys a property that needs a lot of remodel, and it's a night and day difference when she's done with it. It is a true flip with that. And that is a way to turn your property into investment. It's kind of like, is the moral of the story here, right? I mean, so you can turn it into an investment, but most people, as commonly purchased, are not. Is that right, Mindy?
Right. And the people who bought the house around the corner for $598,000, their home is not an investment, even though it's the exact same house I have, because they paid top dollar for it. And I really was scraping the bottom of the barrel when I bought my house.
So thinking about a new home buyer, and they're the first-time home buyers that want everything shiny and new. They want to walk in. They want that just moment where everything's perfect. The kitchen is fabulous. The bathrooms are amazing versus the fixer-upper type experience. So if you're a new home buyer, how do you know which way to go on that?
Well, if you're listening to this podcast and you want to read a book, and you're the kind of person who wants to read a book on buying a first home, you know, you're probably at least open-minded enough to be convinced like, hey, there's no wrong answer here. You can buy the place that Mindy's neighbors bought, and that's fine, but they're not making an investment. They're making a very expensive purchase. Our book is designed to help you lower the cost of your decision and understand those costs, right? They might have made $1 million purchase, right? $500,000 down payment, and then over the life of the loan, they're going to pay $1 million over this, and their payback period, you know, where this becomes a cheaper option than renting an equivalent lifestyle, is going to be 7-8 years, and they're going to live a very expensive lifestyle. And I just don't think those costs are front and center. So I think the first step is just understand the magnitude of the decision and all of the ramifications around that. Understand that other options exist, like what Mindy's doing, or like what I did, which is a different version of what Mindy did. I bought a duplex, rented out the other side of that, and was able to buy a rental property with my first purchase and do that a few times to springboard my way into building a rental property portfolio. That's another way to turn your house into investment. And there's a whole spectrum here across this. You don't have to do anything anywhere near as extreme as Mindy and I did. But the closer you get to having a property that would make sense as a rental, the closer you get to places that you can do at least some moderate touch-up work and improve it over time, you're going to save a lot of money on your purchase and get moved closer and closer to the territory of actually making money on your home purchase over a reasonable period of time.
Tell me about your book, First-Time Homebuyer. How did you both decide what goes in the book, what is not in the book? How did you start that process?
Yeah, so we think that, you know, in the world of money, housing is the largest expense for Americans today. It's about a third of household spending in the average American household budget. And we think there's a lot of basic information out there about guiding you through the process that doesn't exist. And the way we structured the book is kind of in three parts. One, the first part is the strategy of home buying, thinking through, understanding at a fundamental level that housing is, as most people do it, not an investment, it is an expense. Understanding that exit options exist and that you need to think through more than just the buy and pray approach, where I buy the property, hope I like it, and that it will go up in a reasonable period of time. That there are exit strategies like fixing up the property and forcing appreciation, or keeping it as a rental, short or long term, after you move out. So we think that that's a $100,000 or several hundred thousand dollar framework that a lot of people lack or aren't even aware of going into the home buying process, to think through the strategy of that. The second part of the book is all about putting yourself in position to get a good deal. So think about the framework I described earlier, where you look at the sold listings, determine exactly what you want. You know, offering the right price on a deal instead of panicking and buying the least bad listing that is currently active might save you tens of thousands of dollars, for example. It's a lower stakes decision than making the right strategic choice, but still a very high stakes decision. And then the third part of the book is about all the tips and tricks and overwhelming parts of the process that come into literally buying real estate, like the inspection and how terrifying your inspector is going to be when they tell you that your house is about to fall down, what to worry about, what not to, how to kind of develop frameworks for moving through the literal process of the transaction, which can be thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars there, what to negotiate on and when to know when to back off, and those types of things.
Yeah, I really wanted to cover that particular section of the book because as an agent, I know a lot of people, I work with a lot of first-time homebuyers who have no idea what they're doing. And my sister was also a first-time homebuyer, and her agent, instead of asking her sister, who knows a lot of agents, she found somebody off of a sign. Her agent didn't tell her what to do. I am, quite frankly, probably a bit too much up in my client's business. I want you to know that there's a deadline coming up. You may not realize this, but you've signed a legal contract and you are contractually obligated to meet this deadline. You're not going to miss it if I have anything to do with it. And I think that there's a lot of people out there who don't really understand that this deadline is, you know, that's a hard and fast deadline. You can't ask for anything after that deadline. You have to meet this deadline or the contract ends. I wanted people to understand the process of buying a house because I think there's a lot of questions that go unanswered. And I don't know if you've ever talked to a friend and asked them, hey, did you like your agent? And they said, no, I didn't feel she helped me. I didn't feel like she answered my questions. I didn't feel like I was a priority. You know, I wanted people to have a resource to find answers for all of the things, because it is a long and drawn out process. And, you know, why make a mistake when you don't have to?
Exactly. And why make an expensive mistake if you don't have to?
Yeah, it's never a cheap one.
No, it is never a cheap one. Well, let's say I've listened to this episode. Step A, obviously, I'm picking up your book. But step B, I want to buy my first house. What are some action steps that I should start thinking about right now to bring that into reality?
What do you want in a home? Back to what Scott was saying, when you're thinking about, should I buy, should I rent? What is it that you want in a home? And what do you want your mortgage payment to be? How much mortgage are you going to get? What sort of down payment do you have? And does it exist? Go onto the sold listings in Zillow and Redfin, or ask an agent if you've got an agent. If you don't have an agent, find an agent. Talk to a lot of agents. Don't just interview one person and say, okay, you're my agent. Make sure you've got an agent who speaks the same language you do, who communicates in the manner that you want to communicate in. And, you know, then reassess your situation and see, is buying the right choice for me? And if it is, pick up the book, read it all the way through, and start learning your market, start recognizing what you want, and start getting listings from your agent so you can make Scott, how do you say that? Calmly act quickly.
Prepare to act aggressively. I'm not making an offer sight unseen with no thought ahead of time. I am just defining exactly what I want and waiting for it to appear on the market, and then just responding right away. You have to do that in order to make a firm competitive offer right away in this market, but it doesn't mean you're making an instantaneous decision or a knee-jerk reaction. You're just going fishing.
Awesome. Well, you guys are, you have so much information, be it on your podcast, Bigger Pockets. Obviously, this book is just jam-packed with great information. But I would love for you to tell everyone listening where they can listen to the podcast, connect with you, and of course, grab a copy of the book.
The podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. It's called Bigger Pockets Money. We talk about the journey to financial freedom on Mondays, and we dive deep into someone's finances on Friday to see if there's any tweaks they can make to their finances so that they can further themselves down the path to financial independence a little bit sooner. We're both employees of biggerpockets.com, which is a real estate investing social network. We are both all over the site, and you can reach us at Mindy@biggerpockets.com or Scott@biggerpockets.com.
Yes, we also wrote a book. It's called First Time Home Buyer. You can find that at biggerpockets.com/FTHB for First Time Home Buyer, or you can just go to our bookstore and buy it. You can also buy it anywhere books are sold.
I really wish I would have had this book and their podcast before I bought my first house, but luckily for you, you can. The First Time Home Buyer book is a must-have manual for success. And even if you're buying house number 2 or 3, there's so much in there for you to learn. I definitely suggest picking up a copy. If you learned something today, do me a favor, share this episode with friends right now. Tell them what they can learn about buying their first home. As a reminder, you can head to our show notes for links to episode sponsors and all of our guests. And make sure that you hit subscribe and follow in any podcast player so you can always be aware of upcoming episodes. I'll see you back here in a few days for a brand new episode, and I hope you have the best day ever.
Hey, you. Yes, you. Before you go, we want to say thanks for listening to this episode of Millennial Money. For all the links, tags, and ads you've heard on today's episode, check out the show notes or go to mmoneypodcast.com, where you'll find more episodes to share with your friends. While you're at it, leave us a review and make sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you don't miss out on all the money tips and tricks that will take you from a millennial regular to a millennial money expert. See you back here in a few days with a fresh new episode.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal, simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal, only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.